KBOO has the...
And thanks for calling from Nebraska, by the way. Thank you.
Yes, and best information. Now, I'm wondering that I do believe that there is a culling going on. I think it's complicated in one respect, but people, just some ideas, people are not recognizing their own shadow side, and so they cannot see the shadow side of the society as a whole. So if more, I mean, a lot of us...
I hear what you're saying. You're saying by shadow side, you mean that part of them they don't want to acknowledge is there, the lesser part, the worst part.
Yes, the destructive side and the selfish side.
Yes.
And that some of these people who, I mean, it's very obvious, it seems like, that there isn't the necessary work being done to help quell this horrible situation here with people dying and everything. So it seems so obvious that it's being done on purpose, whether it's conscious or a lot of people buying into it subconsciously for one reason or another. But that's mainly what I want to say, that it is going on, however it's going on. If it was purposely let loose,
No, I'm going to have to let you go right now. I see that we just have run out of time. Thank you so much for calling. I think we got your point. And I want to thank all of you out there in the KBOO audience, and I want to encourage you also to donate to KBOO. If you've enjoyed this program, if you've liked coming to it, it's kboo.fm/give. And we're in the middle of a time when we would be having a membership drive, but we've chosen not to because we don't want to gather people together. So we really need your support as a community radio station. So I want to thank you for listening. I'll thank all of you who can donate and do donate. And I want to thank Sonia for being our great engineer today. Bye. Promotion, don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs.
This is KBOO Portland. It's just after 9 a.m. and it is time for Press Watch with your host, Teresa Mitchell. Stay tuned.
Good morning. This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind a video veil of monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. The pandemic has brought many aspects of our benighted society into relief, not least the unrelieved hierarchy of white supremacy as death stalks first those who have been stressed most by our stagnant capitalist system. With the call to return to work, it seems that our super-rich rulers and their wholly owned subsidiaries in Congress would like us to consider ourselves dispensable, heroically dispensable, they smile, heroes for the glorious system of exploitation that has created the worst distribution of wealth in history. It's no accident that black and indigenous people are being slaughtered by this illness, that 50% of the victims in New Mexico are indigenous although they make up only 11% of the population there. The employment rate was brought up again and again by the supporters of the Trump presidency and by Trump himself, and indeed those numbers went up, though it is doubtful Trump had anything to do with that. But the pandemic has brought out just how loathsome it is to have a job or three jobs that does not pay enough for a stable life, not even enough for basic health care. Now, even that thin fare is gone. The pandemic is indeed a global disaster, but so much more so in the United States, where it has revealed the long-burning disaster of our low wages, unstable work prospects, and greedy housing prices. We have not seen our desperation so clearly before, but now we see each other in line at the food bank. What shall we do with this new knowledge? I have Arun Gupta here to help answer that question. He is the founding editor of The Independent magazine and was the founding editor of Occupy Wall Street Journal. He is a writer for The Guardian and other major publications, and I do value his opinion. And if the wires are working correctly, then he is on the line now. Are you there, Arun?
This is Sonia, the engineer. The technology gods have not smiled upon us this morning. I've been unable to connect with Mr. Gupta. So, it's all you, Teresa, for the moment.
All right. All right, well, that happens. And, you know, as it happens, I thought about this program over the last couple of days, and at first I was at a loss. I think that I am just as stunned as everyone else about events. But once I got into it, I realized that I was exploding with things to say. And there's a lot to say. First, I should tell you that there is breaking news that Rick Bright, the man who was sacked for daring to go against President Trump's hucksterism of hydrochloroquine, he has been live on air. I've been watching him on CBS News. The hearings before Congress are being carried. And have some information here. I'm just going to read from those notorious communists at USA Today. Rick Bright, they write, an immunologist who said he was unfairly ousted from the Department of Health and Human Services, said he was quite alarmed to learn that the United States would have a shortage of swabs, and even more surprised to learn that there weren't any in the national stockpile. Bright said that he needed Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar to request help from the Defense Department to fly back swabs and other needed supplies from overseas. But when he and a colleague tried to raise the issue at a senior leadership meeting with Robert Cadillac, the Assistant Secretary for Emergency Preparedness and Response, Cadillac said he didn't want to talk about swabs. We were rebuffed, Bright said. Instead, Bright said he reached out to White House Trade Advisor Peter Navarro, who quickly contacted the Defense Department, and flights were started in 2 days. That's one of the stories that's coming out about I could say that the Trump administration was unprepared, but it's also coming out very much, and again, not that it's really a surprise, that the Trump administration was unconcerned with how many people were dying and was concerned principally with how to manipulate people into believing that Trump is the right person to be president in the election. And I agree with an article in Alternet, which is talking about how the press has been far too easy on Trump, and you would think that the opposite would be true. But the U.S. corporate press has a habit of going easy on authority. And with Trump in power, this is even more disastrous than usual. It's something that over the years on this program, I've criticized, especially as it relates to imperialism, that horrific decisions, killing thousands and even millions of people related to U.S. war efforts are given a pass as if they were moral or necessary. And this is, you know, it's not a new thing. I mean, one of the things that I carefully memorized when I first started doing this sort of work 30 years ago is the fact that the Vietnam War, for example, was not, as we are constantly told, as we are inculcated, as appears in our textbooks, it was not it was not motivated by a pushback against communism nearly as much as it was motivated by a greedy desire for oil, tin, rubber, rice, and cheap labor from Vietnam. It was done in competition with communism, but there's a reason that the U.S. didn't invade Poland during that time. As I was saying, the crisis that we are in now may be principally attributed to Trump, and this is becoming more obvious as more information comes out about his efforts to stop the perception that the pandemic was coming, even as the pandemic grew broader and more disastrous. His principal concern was making the public believe that it wasn't any big deal and that it would just go away. We've heard that over and over. And at this point, aside from more than 80,000 deaths in the U.S., and who knows how many people's lives have been disrupted in ways aside from death, and of course 80,000 is a low number, 35 million people have officially applied for unemployment. 35 million officially, and that means that given the carefully diluted unemployment statistics that have been in place since the Reagan administration to protect capitalism from the public's perception of what it actually does, it means that far more than that are affected by unemployment. I would say easily double. At this point, most of the workforce, if you'll pardon me for using that term, is in a fraught situation, either looking at being fired or laid off or having hours reduced. And this even ironically applies to doctors. I want to quote from and comment on an article in Alternet, which points to a CNN interview with the New York Times journalist Donald McNeil. And he, McNeil, actually in early February, warned of the novel coronavirus. And very specifically, and basically told us it was coming. And he explained on CNN and was quoted in Alternet why so many other countries have controlled the virus much better than the United States. And he's quoted saying, "We completely blew it for the first 2 months of our response. We were in a headless chicken phase." And that's a quote. And a quote further saying, "And yes, it's the president's fault. It's not China's fault. You know, the head of the Chinese CDC was on the phone with U.S. CDC Director Robert Redfield on January 3rd, again on January 8th, and the two agencies were talking on January 19th. The Chinese had a test on January 13th. The Germans had a test on January 16th. We fiddled around for 2 months. We had a test on March 5th, and it didn't work. We didn't have 10,000 people tested until March 15th. So we lost 2 months there, and that was because of incompetent leadership at the CDC. I'm sorry to say it's a great agency, but it's incompetently led, and I think Dr. Redfield should resign," end quote. And so this is a prominent journalist at the New York Times, which is certainly one of the organizations I would point to in that category and in that paradigm that I was referring to just a moment ago, that they are so easy on imperialism. The name Judith Miller comes to mind. And even he comes out and says that the head of the CDC should resign. I want to contrast what we're experiencing here in the United States, this great disaster, this greater redepression that we're facing, is surely Trump's fault. And we can see that when we look, for example, at New Zealand, who in New Zealand they have competent leadership by and large. And the that country seized the opportunity to act on the information months ago, carefully, like South Korea, like some other advanced semi-democracies, seized the information, did testing in the first place, and did contact tracing. And now in New Zealand, the virus is almost completely eradicated. And so you can see scenes on video of New Zealanders enjoying themselves in pubs, getting haircuts. The society has opened up, and it is opened up on a rational basis. They don't have to fear it, because they are not led by a greedy, venal fool who is supported by 63 million greedy, venal fools. And it's a shocking thing when you think about it. I think that the press in the U.S. Simply doesn't have the chops in a lot of cases to explain to the American public just how badly they're being led. Of course, there are exceptions, and some of that was in an alternate. So I'm going to read and comment from that as well, an article in alternate. But before I do, I want to address the dilemma that we face here, that we don't have our interview subject in two ways. I want to ask the engineer, Sonia, thank you very much for trying. Could you try one more time to reach Arun? And I would like to invite your calls. And that might run into difficulty, because if you hear Arun's voice, that means I won't be taking your call. But I want to go both routes here and ask you to risk it if you have something to ask, if you have a question, or if you have comments on the coronavirus situation. And if you're like me, then you're just exploding with comments. You've got a lot to say. And one of the principal things I want to say is that we are being killed. This is homicide. And I do believe, as I said before, that it is not that this homicide is being carried out with the aid of the powerful and persistent paradigm of white supremacy in this nation. People who support Trump particularly can easily tell themselves, in whatever voice and whatever level of conscious apprehension, that they don't have to worry about it. It's those other people, and it's the othering that does it. And this is one of the things that has made me say that the United States always was the perfect petri dish for this disease. Let me count the ways. There are overcrowded because we're a police state. We're a police state, and we won't acknowledge that we're a police state. We are a people who must fear the police. There's a few people who don't have to fear the police, and of course they are the people, just as in any police state, the people who have the most clout. Who doesn't need to fear the police? It's obvious. We see it over and over again. A white man doesn't have to fear the police, even if, and this is a significant point, even if he has a gun strapped to his waist and is acting out, he doesn't have to fear the police. To get shot by the police takes some work. But to get shot by the police as a black, indigenous, or person of color is something that it's a risk that you take every day that you step out in public, and you're not even safe in your homes. This is a police state. We must rise up. We have a right to defend ourselves against Trump, against the police. And this has been defined in treaties. This is part of the acknowledgement of the right of a people to go to war against oppressive leaders. It's enshrined in the International Declaration of Human Rights. It is our right. It has always been our right. And when I say our, I mean all of us who do not subscribe to white supremacy. And the white supremacy is so pervasive that I can't even say it about myself. I can't say that I can go out and be free of white supremacy. Not only do I benefit and profit from it greatly every single day, and certainly in that way that as a white woman, you know, as long as I keep my mouth shut and walk a certain way, I can pass. I can walk out without fear. This is a wonderful profit for me under the category of white supremacy. But it shouldn't be, of course, that anyone has to fear the police. What an obvious thing to say, right? It shouldn't be why do we accept a police state? We have a right to rise up, and this is the time. I don't know if there will ever be a better time for revolution, for us to rise up with consideration, with love in our hearts for each other, with reflection on what it means and how to do this best with the least violence. This is the time to rise up. This is the time for a revolution, this time in which we are being actively killed by the tiny fraction of the elite that must have our labor to aggregate by the billions, by the trillions. We don't have trillionaires yet, but we're getting too close. $1 billion is an unimaginable amount of money. It is the wealth of kings, of emperors. We have billionaires because of this maldistribution of wealth, because of all of our work and because of the accumulation of all our technology, which has been built up by all of us over centuries. And now, instead of being rewarded, instead of having a utopia in which we are freed from oppressive work, we see that instead we are forced to work 2 and 3 jobs and still not have enough. Not only enough, we don't have enough to cover our basic expenses and even enough for our health care, which is ridiculously, horribly, cruelly restricted to health denial organizations that we call health insurance organizations. But there's also a loss of hope. We have not been granted enough of the wealth that we produce to have any hope, so that people kill themselves. People kill themselves when they lose their jobs because they can't make the mortgage and they can't make the rent. And they've been taught to value themselves with how much they can spend. And certainly, there is, aside from that, if you don't have work, and especially if you have kids, you look forward to a future in which, if you can't make the rent, you know that you're going to be out. You don't know where you're going to go, and you're likely to end up with your kids in the back of the car eating free cheese sandwiches, and you would have to ask yourself, what kind of a mother or a father am I? That wouldn't be a fair question under these circumstances, but people do ask it, and they jump off the bridges, and they take pills, and it's very sad. And so what I'm saying is that the violence of our society is so great that it is irresponsible not to have a revolution. It is irresponsible not to move to revolution. It's not something that should be done lightly. It's not something that should be done on a whim, of course. But it is irresponsible to allow this system of destruction of the planet, destruction of our lives, this system of violence cannot go on. Number of calls, your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. And what is the way? Is there a way? Can I say singularly, is there a way to revolution? I don't think that I can. But there will be a process, and we have got to have that revolution. 503-231-8187. 35 million officially applied for unemployment. And there's a lot of magical thinking going around. The idea that we can have a shock like this and then it suddenly reverse itself is just absurd. It isn't going to happen. It can't happen. It can't happen. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news with that. I've gotten used to it. I've gotten used to being the bearer of bad news. But there is a joy, too, in being the bearer of bad news, in that if I speak the truth, then that is a tool that can be carried towards curing bad news. Now, I use the word cure advisedly here. I was thinking of a passage from the novel that everyone knows of the Great Depression. Actually, I say everyone knows it. Maybe that's because I'm old. I don't know if this is taught in the schools now, since they're all pressured, as part of our subjugation, they're all pressured to teach to the test. But when I was a kid, I had to read The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck and found it horribly depressing. Many of you know this, but I think it is well worth quoting. Here's a quote from The Grapes of Wrath, referring to conditions in the 1930s. The works of the roots of the vines of the trees must be destroyed to keep up the price. And this is the saddest, bitterest thing of all. Carloads of oranges dumped on the ground. The people came for miles to take the fruit, but this cannot be. How can they buy oranges at 20 cents a dozen if they could drive out and pick them up? And men with hoses squirt kerosene on the oranges, and they are angry at the crime, angry at the people who have come to take the fruit. A million people hungry, needing the fruit, and kerosene sprayed over the golden mountains, and the smell of rot fills the country. Burn coffee for fuel in the ships. Burn corn to keep warm. It makes a hot fire. Dump potatoes in the rivers and place guards along the banks to keep the hungry people from fishing them out. Slaughter the pigs and bury them and let the putrescence drip down into the earth. This is John Steinbeck's novel about the 1930s. And you know, if you're following the news at all, that this is happening now again. Quoting again from Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, there is a crime here that goes beyond denunciation. There is a sorrow here that weeping cannot symbolize. There's a failure here that topples all our success. The fertile earth, the straight tree rows, the sturdy trunks and the ripe fruit, and the children dying of pellagra must die because a profit cannot be taken from an orange. And coroners must fill in the certificate, diet of malnutrition, because the food must rot, must be forced to rot. The people come with nets to fish for potatoes in the river, and the guards hold them back. They come in rattling cars to get the dumped oranges where the kerosene is sprayed, and they stand still and watch the potatoes float by, listening to the screaming pigs being killed in a ditch and covered with quicklime, watch the mountains of oranges slop down to a putrefying ooze. And in the eyes of the people, there is the failure, and in the eyes of the hungry, there's a growing wrath. In the souls of the people, the grapes of wrath are filling and growing heavy for the vintage, end quote. That quote woke up, and the fact that so many people read it and that the novel is so popular, it woke up a great many politicians who were, as they are now, seeking first and foremost to protect capitalism and to protect the system of hierarchy and of denial that makes people work for capitalism. And it made changes because at that time there was competition, strong competition, and people like Albert Einstein were supporting communism and the idea that we should completely change the society and that workers had a right to the fruits of their labor first and foremost. The workers had a right to it. And this was terrifying to the leaders who were just as dependent then as they are now on the great and glorious mountains of wealth that they can personally get, tiny amounts, comparatively speaking, from the very, very rich. And so they acted on things that were considered anathema to them before. They acted on Social Security, and they acted on Medicare and Medicaid. And even as late as the 50s and 60s and 70s, there was that effect of the politicians realizing that they could only go so far. After the fall of the Soviet Union, there was great rejoicing, and deservedly so, because it had become the Soviet system had become so rotten and corrupt, and because of the great horrors that had been unaddressed as long as they maintained power. But there was another effect, and that was great relief in the hearts of the capitalists who support our fully owned subsidiary Congress and the presidency. There was great relief because they realized that that option, that possibility, had now been extinguished. And the shouting against socialism in all its forms increased, and there was a careful and extensive effort to smear it as being merely its crimes, as being nothing more than the dead in Ukraine. Over and over again, we were told this. We were forced to memorize it and answer it in tests in school. Don't even dare think of socialism, and many, many people are still very loyal to that prohibition of thought. But I'm here to call for socialist revolution, and I don't know when there will be a better time. If you've listened to my show for a long time, you know that I've been calling for revolution for 30 years. I'm not ashamed of that. It's always been time for the revolution, and it was way past time for the many, many people who have died under white supremacy and under capitalism and under imperialism and under our police state. This is violence. Our system is violence. The violence has increased. It's a little out of control because the violence now has an agent called coronavirus, called COVID-19, Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. What do you got to say about it? This is Talk Radio on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This show is called Press Watch. You can hear it on the podcast aggregators, wherever you search for podcasts, search for KBOO Press Watch, and you can find this show. You can find many of the KBOO shows. And it is here on KBOO that we can say that the president is a venal and fascistic dictator and back it up. And we can say it every time. And that is a freedom that may become ephemeral, because so many of you right now are in desperation, and I feel for you. And I know how it has happened, and many, many times in my life I have been in that desperate state because I am eccentric and I have many failures. And I have often been in a situation in which I don't know how I'm going to make rent. I'm going to have to beg it from someone. And lucky me, I am white. I was male, as far as anyone could tell. I could get out there and get the funds. I got it from my relatives. I got forbearance from my landladies. I was able to make it happen, but if it weren't for that, you know, that last privilege, I would have spent a lot more time on the streets than I actually did. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Hamilton Nolan writes, "And in these times, there's a strong element of unreality to our time. Incredulousness seems the only suitable attitude towards what is happening to us. Not just the coronavirus itself, a global disaster that we helplessly watch sweeping over us like beachgoers gaping at an incoming tidal wave that is about to wash them away, but also the way members of the economic power structure imagine they will protect themselves from the devastation. They seem to believe they can build themselves a life raft to escape. It's a fantasy. We're going to need a bigger boat." And I want to depart from that that article. As I say, it's by Hamilton Nolan, and in these times. And I would add to that. I would say there is actually, if you're wealthy or if you have white privilege like myself, then you do have a better chance of surviving. And I have been able to survive in my house, even though I'm sick with a kidney disease that should have been operated on months ago and is now being I'm fighting because of coronavirus for my life also. And many people are in that position. But it was because of my privilege that I'm able to sit in my house and my friends come and bring me food. And I'm very grateful to them. And I hope that I survive. I hope that everyone does. But we know that we shall not all survive this. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187.
The
writer. Go ahead.
Teresa, we have, I believe Thomas is waiting. Thomas, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right. You're on the air.
Okay.
Hi, Thomas.
Hey, Teresa. Yeah, hi, Teresa. Hey, listen,
hi.
I really appreciate the radical and revolutionary nature of your comments, because we just don't hear enough about that. We're always told to go and participate every 4 years in an election, pick a savior, and that he's going to save us, and that by participating in this the electoral system and doing all of that sort of thing, the politically right thing, electing Bernie Sanders, and everything will be okay. It's just not going to happen that way, as you well explained. And I think that the revolution is happening. I mean, lately I've just got a lot of hope from the union movement, people like Jane McAlevey and her organizing efforts that she's doing, and the teacher strikes that have happened. I think it was in Virginia where that started. All of that kind of stuff they did that outside of the system that was not authorized by the union. It was not authorized by the political system. These people just rose up and showed us what has to be done on a grander scale. And I read this little book by, this is just one example of it. It's a little book called From Dictatorship to Democracy by Gene Sharp. And he has actually listed in this book, it's an amazing little book, 190 ways how to disrupt the system. And he says basically that the system has to be made ungovernable. That's what has to happen. And you can see that when they did it in the schools with a strike, that's what happens. The school system becomes ungovernable. The teachers walk out, stand there, you know, with their, you know, befuddled as to what they can do. And it gave them the power. They took the power of the people. And that's the thing that's missing. By participating in the political system, people are not using their full power. Although that should probably be done too. We can do more than one thing at a time. And my inspiration for that, you know, you may have to hold your nose here, is Ralph Nader and his experience. He's written a couple of books about how he would do that and how the people have the power to influence and change Congress. Okay, that can be done. People should do that, you know. But I think the real power is in mass movements and people working outside of the system to change the system. Unless the
I have to agree. I mean, I don't want to fall into a false dichotomy of telling myself I can either vote or I can revolt. No, I'll do both. I'll take what little power comes to me through. I will, you know, vote. There's an election coming up here. I believe the 19th is the last day you can vote. Probably you have your ballots. I strongly feel that everyone should fill out their ballot. But, of course, it is in large part simply a way of keeping us from actually acting on the political power that we have lost and that we must regain for ourselves.
And I don't see it, you know, the system as it's set up, when you really think, try to really dig deep into the roots of capitalism, it is never going to provide. Any reforms that are made are always going to be undermined by that system. Basically, we are all slaves. You know, we just don't have a no pay system. We get a little bit of pay. They keep pushing the profits up. They'd love to push the pay down to zero, and that ideal is slavery. Everybody is a wage slave, even if they think they enjoy their job. The system is keeping the people down, and that's just the way it is.
I agree with what you're saying there. I personally am careful to use the word slave because of the context. The slavery in the United States was race slavery and
yes,
particularly onerous and abject. And so
yes,
I'm careful to use that word, but I see where you're going with that, and I quite agree.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you there, Teresa, because I know when I feel like when I say that, I know that the people with slavery in their cultural history are going to feel offended. I mean, I understand that, but you hit it on the head. You know, I don't want to sound that way. I don't want to think that, oh boy, here I am, white privilege, and I'm a slave. Oh, I'm so downtrodden. No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that overall, the whole system, and not falling into any kind of identity sort of politics or anything like that, we're all held down by this system.
Yeah, we've got to look at it clearly. I really agree with that. I mean, I see, you know, Ace Hayes used to say, the frog has been boiled slowly and so has been oblivious to its doom. And that's been very true of what we've all been conditioned to accept. And I think it's been shattering to see so many young people work so hard and introduce a new standard of academic excellence only to be crushed into working three service jobs and having no hope, nothing to look forward to, no ability, no social, I can't think of the word, so not social climbing, but social mobility is, it's a lie in the United States. It's a lie that's constantly repeated, that you can pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and that your hard work will, you know, get you into that, you know, get you into the suburbs. Frankly, 10% of the people in the United States are doing great living in those suburbs, but it is not accessible to the other 90%. It's slightly accessible to the top 20%, and for those of us who are born into poverty who have fallen well into it, it is not accessible, and that's a lie. The idea that, you know, your virtue is going to get you into that address with a neatly clipped lawn and the two-car garage. It ain't happening. But it's a very useful tool.
I think the young people are catching on to this. I mean, I see a lot of despair. They know. They have woken up to what's in store for them and what the system is going to provide to them. And they've got the energy. I'm too old to do this stuff now, but the young people see what's going on, and I think there's an awful lot of energy there, you know, that has to be captured and that has to be used to really, you know, bring the power to the people. The power to the people. You know, remember that? Yeah. Well, that's where it is. Okay, Teresa, that's all I've got to say.
Well, thank you very much for calling in, and you too. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. And I am talking about the economic devastation that has been brought into sharp relief by the pandemic and worsened by the pandemic. And I do want to make a distinction between those two things because we already had economic devastation, and it was grossly disproportionate. That word is prohibited for Republicans to understand. They can hear it, but they can't process it. And many, especially people who enjoy privilege like myself, find a natural aversion to understanding the word disproportionate. Disproportionate kills. And it was killing before the pandemic ever came. And it was cramming our jails and it was making people kill themselves. Disproportionate. Things need to be in proportion. And the disproportionate efforts of the police to attack people of color, black, indigenous, and people of color, the disproportions in the distribution of wealth. We see now with the pandemic that the billionaires, although they have, you know, they have reserves to last them for generations, they are panicked when they realize that we can't work. We should strike and force them to distribute all of our labor, all the benefits of our labor back to us. There should be no billionaires. It is a sign of the sixth society. There should be no such thing, and no one should aspire to it. You know, I would be happy. I think that it is possible to have a society in which our wealth is the equivalent of what a person with $1 million would experience. Now, I think that it is possible that everyone could have that. And I think the motivation to do that is within the hearts of every person. It's what motivates us to do just about everything in life. And the puny motivation of capitalism is only set into action by the desperation that is maintained by capitalism. So the idea that we have to have desperation to have an economy is simply a lie that serves the very, very rich. It is the reality that has been forced on us, and we should rebel against it. It's time, it's past time for revolution. It is irresponsible not to have a revolution. I was reading from Hamilton Nolan's article in These Times and commenting as I go. InTheseTimes.com is where you can find that. It's often abbreviated as ITT. But continuing with what he has written, the economy writ large, he writes, is just the totality of all the stuff we make and do. It is everyone's livelihood. The economy is not Wall Street. It's not stocks or bonds or bankers or debts. These financial instruments and measurements that we often speak of as proxies for the economy are all second or third order derivatives of the millions of people making, doing, and exchanging things that make up the actual substance of the economy. To believe that money is the economy is to mistake the reflection for the thing itself. And he writes, think about what the coronavirus has done, pardon me, to the real economy. It has shuttered businesses and caused the incomes of tens and billions of people to disappear, and therefore caused all of those people to cut their spending and be unable to pay their bills, which then causes declines in other business and other people's incomes and on. It is a crisis, but a crisis of necessity. We had to bring on this voluntary economic shutdown to prevent millions of deaths. The government, the only entity that exists to get the public through times like this, has the ability to replace the money that is not being spent due to our self-imposed shutdown and to get the economy through to the other side of this more or less in peace. The government can give money to people to live, and it can see that businesses are not forced to declare bankruptcy by the thousands, and it can manage this crisis intelligently for the good of everyone, so that we emerge with as little damage as possible. And he writes, that simple and rational path is not the path that our government has taken. It has not taken that path because, unfortunately, our government has long been captured by the interests of the rich for reasons that have been well explained many times before. Instead, our government has pursued a plan that has been extremely competent and generous when it comes to propping up financial institutions and the value of financial assets, but extremely parsimonious and incompetent when it comes to providing an adequate financial safety net to human beings and small businesses. And there's much more to that article, but I just want to comment. It's not an accident. This is how a system of oppression is maintained. It is maintained through the shock. The shock doctrine is being activated now. We were warned about this by Naomi Klein in her book. Pardon me. But this is why things are being done the way that they are. And of course, we now can look at other countries and see that even in Canada, people are being given a steady income. The wealth and the potential wealth of the government is so great that this isn't actually a problem. And we've always been held off from distribution of our needs. That power has been taken from us, and one of the excuses, that the most powerful one that is always brought up, is saying, well, how will we pay for it? Well, now we see that paying for it was never a problem. It was always a system of oppression. It always depended. There's more going on here than necessity. And in fact, as business owners have distributed time and time again, as business owners have proven time and again, they would prefer to accidentally lose money than to share power. So this is about the venality of a sick system. This is about the fact that the government will not distribute what we need, which is at a minimum $2,000 for each of us for a length of months, many months, until we can get this pandemic under control. This is something the government easily can do, and the reason it doesn't do it is because this government exists for the greedy and venal parasites who direct it, who pay for it.
Teresa, we have a caller.
Cannot be otherwise. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. But before I go to the next caller, I want to say that we're not able to do our pledge drive in the usual way. This spring we would have had a pledge drive, and it would have been a week or so, and we would have raised our tens of thousands of dollars, and I don't need to tell you why we are not now doing it. And I've been talking about how most of you, and I know particularly KBOO listeners, are hardest hit by this. There is a richer, whiter spinoff of KBOO that's been successfully fundraising. It's going to be harder for us, and I don't want to ask those of you who are out of work and who are in desperation to support KBOO. You can, you know, get off the hook morally for that. I'm not talking to you when I say we need money, but I am talking to very few of you enlightened and yet affluent people. There's a very few of you, very few, who listen to KBOO. Those of you who can, this is the time for you to step up and to hit the website right now, kbo.fm, where you may be listening, and hit the contribution button. You have step up because you're the only persons who understand why, and you're the only persons who can. And we just had to turn away 80 something thousand dollars from the government because it's going to hurt us to take that loan. We need $80,000. I'm talking to those of you who have some money. This is the time for you to think about what's important to you. If it's, you know, if this radio station is important to you, if this ability to speak truth to power is important to you, and I know it is for some of you, if you have those dollars, I want you to hit the website right now and give us $1,000 if you can. Give us $1,000. For those of you who don't know how you're going to make rent, I'm glad we're still here for you. And And, you know, the people who can do that, they have done that over the years. We occasionally get such donations, and we're still afloat because of everyone's little donations and because of people who can will occasionally give us substantial funds. I'm very grateful for that, but this is the time. Right now, I mean right now. Please pull up the website, kbo.fm. Number to call, 503-231-8187. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. It's 9:48 a.m. I'm going to go to the next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Teresa.
Hi.
Spring, Onyx, Swart. And I'm calling to thank you because all that you do and everything you say is so right on.
All right,
and,
thanks for holding. By what name shall we introduce you when you're up?
Pardon?
Okay, they're the engineers there just for a moment. Okay. All right.
I'm sorry. Did we just connect?
We are connecting, and I can hear you are on the air right now.
Okay. You haven't heard anything else I've said?
I have heard what you said.
In last month, as soon as, you know, all of this is ongoing.
Well, thank you very much.
Don't know what I would do without walking my talk and speaking truth to power, and when next we can be in the streets together through solidarity. Teresa, I love you so much, and I don't know if you're still driving the bus, but you know, you are one of our frontline workers. Pardon?
I've retired, fortunately.
Oh, good. Well, I've been retired a few years myself, so I lived on a fixed income, but I found $120 to send in. You are in dire straits, and maybe I need to send in $120, but you're just so important to my mental health and everything. And Democracy Now, without Democracy Now, 5 days a week, you know, they are my primary news source, and they have been for many, many, many years. So thank you so much. Hugs and kisses to you and Ani, and I hope to see you in July if we're able to open back up. Who knows? But I just can't thank you enough, Teresa.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the boost. Well, you know, it's funny. I was just talking with Ani about the show, and I was saying that one of the things I wanted to say was that it's time to directly confront Fox News. And I would like to see, across the nation, I would like to see Fox News outlets confronted by protesters. And we were talking about, you know, what would be the punchy slogan. We couldn't come up with a good one. We were saying, we need sloganeers. And Ani was joking, saying, down with bullish demagoguery. And it's just like, well, I won't sit on that sign quite exactly, but someone will come up with a good phrase. But I think that as we acknowledge the fact that Donald Trump has been killing us, so have his supporters, and one of his most powerful supporters is, you know, the greedy capitalists who run Fox News, and through their absolute absence of morality promote whatever lie he comes up with, because they are so intoxicated with power, and he is in power, and he more than any other president aggregates his power by the use of manipulating persons who lack education, by using cheap tricks that work with the dim-witted, frankly. And aside from the offensiveness of that, it is effective. It's a cheap way to go, but it works, and he is working it as hard as he possibly can, and Fox News is helping him kill us. I think that needs to be understood. It's really an obvious truth if you think about it. The power that is projected through controlling people's minds through the lies on Fox News is helping Donald Trump kill people by the tens of thousands and destroy the economy. And they should be confronted. Absolutely. They should not be able to just roll into work and do their thing day after day and not deal with our righteous anger and not deal with our
our peaceful fury that they should do this thing. They cannot pretend any longer. I think that we have to confront them. And maybe the slogan is something like Stop Fox Lies or something like that, or just Fox Lies. Whatever, just the basic thing needs to be said, that they are extremely predatory and they are hurting us constantly with their broadcasts and their lies. They don't have a right to do that sort of thing and to lie so powerfully to all of us without being answered. They can think what they want, they can say what they want, but they can't be free from the consequences of what they do and say. They can't be cosseted by the idea that their lies are so protected that they can't be answered. We must answer their lies. This is a huge part of the power of the demagogue, the monster in power right now.
All right. Well, we've got a caller on hold right now. Shall we bring LJ into the mix?
Okay, number to call 503-231-8187, and LJ is on. Hi, LJ.
Hey, Teresa, how are you?
Doing well. Well,
okay, good deal.
Well. Actually, I'm sick, let me be honest.
Yeah, I know. You mentioned it. There was a transgendered woman on Democracy Now, I think, who also died of kidney failure. She brought some kind of lawsuit and she passed from.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. That kind of caught my attention. It's like she's my age, she's transgender. You know, she's gone. I was thinking, well, okay, double down on my efforts to get surgery.
Yeah, really. Any which way, what I'd like to bring up is the dire situation that's being faced by the Navajo Nation.
Yeah.
In New Mexico and in Arizona, there's a disproportionate number of indigenous people who are dying from the coronavirus. As a matter of fact, according to what I understand, it's the third worst outbreak in the country. Third to New York, New Jersey, and then comes the Navajo Nation. Now, it's my understanding that the coronavirus was brought in by a pastor who holds revival meetings, right? And which attracts a lot of people, and he gives them the word about how Jesus is going to save them and all that crap, and they end up with this coronavirus, and being that they live in tribally, it just keeps on. It has taken a foothold. It's gotten so bad.
I've got to say that one of the most efficient ways to spread coronavirus, as it turns out, is to everyone get together and shout or sing. It's unfortunately, it's a very efficient way of spreading the coronavirus. We saw that in a church in South Korea as well. There was a tremendous spread within, you know, everyone gets together and normally I think it's a wonderful thing actually for people to get together and sing. It's really good for you, but under these circumstances, it's deadly. And the indigenous in Arizona and New Mexico are so powerfully oppressed that the only annual plague deaths, and I mean the Black Plague, happen in those areas. That's how poor they are kept. That is how deprived they are forced to be. And so now the coronavirus has gotten there, and the vicious and violent deprivation that this nation imposes upon the indigenous is once again brought into visibility by the light of the pandemic. And I'm glad you brought it up. You still there, LJ?
That Doctors Without Borders are going to be helping to treat that situation.
Yeah. it's really brought things into relief. I was just thinking about, we've been talking about socialism more in the last couple of years than I have ever heard in my life, and I was greatly buoyed by that. Now it's time to bring that thinking into practical motion, because the alternative is a destroyed planet and an unending pandemic. There are economic aspects to ending this pandemic. People have to have the power to stay home, and we're not granting them that. And oh my goodness, it's the top of the hour. I'm running out of time. LJ, thank you so much for calling in. And I want to thank all of those of you who called in. I did expect to have an interview for this hour, and didn't happen for whatever reason. I hope that Irene's okay. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. And as I was saying, it's almost the top of the hour, so I want to quote briefly from another article that I encourage you to turn to. It's on alternet.org. It says, unemployment statistics were dire as many had expected. The U.S. Department of Labor released an unemployment rate for April of 14.7%. And speaking for myself, I want to point out that that's the official rate, which means it's half of the actual, at least. The worst since the Great Depression, and far surpassing the worst days of the Great Recession. In light of these numbers, it's not surprising that cries for opening up the economy would gain traction among many working-class citizens. There's more of that article. I encourage you to read it, because it is underlining the point that I want to make of how violent and how vicious this call for return to work is. How much better you would be doing if you lived, say, in New Zealand or Denmark or anywhere but the United States. And we are being killed. And the people who are killing us have names and faces. And they are, by and large, Republicans, but not entirely. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, going out to you on our great big red and white transmitter on the West Hills, our Eiffel Tower, via 90.7 FM and more than 20,000 watts. We're proud to have that. And it's going out to you in different frequencies across Oregon and southern Washington, and going out to you via KBOO.FM, and in that